This week on Video Culture, we'll talk Brandon Lee with Rapid Fire and The Crow. Yes, that The Crow. You want to stay tuned.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast. In a place where everyone has an opinion. Two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills. There will be thrills, and there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And welcome to another episode of Video Culture. I'm your host, Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And today we are talking about the late, great, the gone too soon, Brandon Lee.
Son of the great Bruce Lee, but a fine actor and a fine movie star in his own right.
Definitely. He only starred in five movies. Starred in a few different television appearances.
He had a few different TV gigs, yeah. But he was in five films. I would say only about three of them, four of them are pretty good. One's kind of bad.
Right.
But we're really going to talk about his two most noteworthy films today.
Right. And everybody should at least at this point know or have heard about the movie The Crow. There's been several sequels, including one starring Edward Furlong.
There was a
Iggy Pop, I think, was in one of them.
Yeah, there was a TV show. Yeah.
There's been talk of, it's 2016, talk of another, like, reboot of The Crow with Jason Momoa.
Yeah, almost happened, then fell apart.
Yeah.
Rob Zombie almost made a remake.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. It's a popular film.
It's a popular film. Well, and then we are also going to explore one of Brandon Lee's other popular movie. Not quite as popular as The Crow, but another from that time period.
It's actually from the year before, 1992.
1992.
They filmed The Crow in 1993, and it was released in 1994.
Right.
But yeah, in 1992, he put out Rapid Fire.
So Rapid Fire is an action movie. And when I mean action movie, I mean you're talking 1992. You know, this is the era of Die Hard, Lethal Weapon, Steven Seagal movies.
Van Damme, yeah.
Yeah, Van Damme. So yeah, it runs. It is a action movie of that sort of a, you know, street. There's, you know, drug lords and
there's gunfire. There's punching, kicking, good guys versus bad guys, cops on the edge,
martial arts. You know, I mean because basically Brandon Lee plays a character named Jake Lowe, who comes over from the United States, I guess, sort of after the Tiananmen Square incident in China.
Yeah.
And he's kind of a martial arts expert.
Yes.
You don't really get a background of why he's a martial arts expert.
No, it's just one of those things. It's one of those kind of maybe a little bit racist ideas where if you're Asian, you're good at martial arts. Where they should say, oh, he's Asian. Everyone knows he's Bruce Lee's son in real life. We don't need to explain that he knows how to throw a kick.
Yeah, right. You know? Or he can just, you know, just like straight up kill these guys in like, you know, a minute and a half, you know, with like nothing but a fork or something.
I want to backtrack for just a second. I find it interesting that almost 20 episodes, we finally got to talking about a true action film. It's the first time we've ever really talked about a movie where the intent was just to enjoy action, which is really what the point of action films are.
Yeah.
No, they're not. They're it's not about social consciousness. It's not about delivering a message. It's not about making you laugh. It's about thrilling you.
I think the closest one to this that we've done so far up to this episode was The Last Boy Scout. But even The Last Boy Scout was a lot of drama. It's almost like a buddy cop movie. As
kind
long
of a detective
with a,
film in a way with a little bit of comedy.
Right.
This movie, Rapid Heart especially, is really only interested in thrilling you.
Right.
Action and good fights.
Yep.
You know, so, but anyway, back to the plot. So, so you have Brandon Lee's character who's come to America from China.
Right.
And he goes to a party.
Yeah.
For kind of, you know, convoluted reasons. And he ends up witnessing a mob hit, which happens in action films where apparently mobsters are just killing guys everywhere in these kind of films. It's kind of a witness sort of situation where he inadvertently sees a mob hit. He gets a look at the gangster who did it. And then he becomes a witness for the cops. And the mafia wants to kill him now to prevent him from testifying. If this doesn't sound very deep, guys, it's because it's not. And with action films, that's A-okay. Because you know what's great about this film? The action and Brandon Lee's performance.
Well, I thought it was interesting that they started off the movie, you know, sort of following the two main bad guys.
Yes.
And like why they're sort of at odds with one another. How the American Powers Booth. Powers Booth is the actor.
Who,
What was his name? Antonio Serrano?
Yes.
Okay. Who was played by Nick Mancuso.
Yeah. And who's been in a lot of movies as a gangster. He's one of those guys who plays gangsters pretty much.
Right. And he you know, he comes over to like Asia because he wants to negotiate. And he's like, no, I want part of your business. But then it's like sort of found out later that through the grapevine that like the reason he was is because all of his guys have gotten put away because the cops are basically after him.
Yeah.
And so he doesn't have, you know, as much money flowing in as he would have.
And what's clever about that little plot device is it explains why they don't just overrun the hero with bad guys and just take him out really easily.
Right.
They're short on guys. So like one really talented martial artist action hero type can stand toe-to-toe with this really small gaggle of bad guys.
Right. Yeah, and I really, this is, and also, let's just go through the other, some of the other people that are in it. Powers Booth plays Lieutenant Mace Ryan, and he's the guy that has to get sort of Jake Lowe sort of on the good guy side of, like, putting these people away. Because Jake is like, you know, why should I care? I don't want to be involved in all of this.
Yeah, I'm young, I'm handsome, I'm in college, I don't care.
Yeah.
I just want to go to school and meet girls, you know.
Yeah, well, he's an art major.
Yeah. And that's actually plays into the plot because that's how he ends up fingering the bad guy is he does a really detailed like police sketch of what the bad guy looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a fun little detail that really serves no other purpose. They didn't have to do it, but it's just kind of neat.
Yeah, it looked like a drawing from like that Aha video or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but back to what's going on. But yeah, but that's basically what happened. So you kind of have like a kind of like a three way or a four way because you have you know one bad guy after another bad guy. But the one bad guy like doesn't even know that Jake Lowe even exists.
Yeah.
Right? He's just he doesn't. He's just you know after. You know, Antonio Serrano, basically.
Yeah. He's not even really there till almost till the end of the film. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then, like, the Lieutenant Mace Ryan, he's trying to bring basically everybody down at this point.
Yeah. And basically, he has kind of like the banter with Jake Lowe, with Brandon Lee's character. You see, in these movies, there's always going to be kind of a foil for the hero, someone to kind of banter with and you know, show how clever the hero is with his witty commentary.
Kate Hodge plays the love interest for Brandon Lee's character. Plays Detective Carla Withers.
Yes,
and then also one of the henchmen guys, a guy that you always see in movies. I love this guy. Well, there's two guys that you see. One is Tony Longo, and he's one of these just like brute, you know, sort of guys that you just see in all these different movies. Yeah. Great, great character actor.
He's basically a henchman for life, basically.
Yeah.
And speaking of henchmen for their entire career, the next guy, which is the great Al Long.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Al Long, you'll recognize him once I describe him. He's got long hair. He's balding. He's obviously Chinese, and he's got a Fu Manchu beard and mustache. He's most widely known as being Genghis Khan in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Yep.
And he plays side characters in several John Carpenter movies.
Yeah, he was one of the guys for the good guy team, I guess you would call it, in
Big Trouble in Little China. Yeah, they have several close ups of him in that movie because he looks like a guy who can fight. Mm-hmm. He looks rough and tumble.
Right.
Yeah, but if you guys have a chance, go to his IMDb and just look at all the movies he's in, because it's kind of amazing just the sheer amount of stuff he was in and the memorable stuff he was in.
I think they probably even based the Mortal Kombat character off of him or something.
He certainly looks like he belongs in a video game like that, for right, sure.
Yeah. But essentially, the thing about this movie that I found most interesting is, like you said, it's an action movie. Is it just like... It never sort of stops. It never sort of lulls. It just like...
Would you say it moves rapidly?
Oh, my gosh. I'm supposed to make the, like, dad jokes. You know, but... Yeah, I mean, exactly. It had a nice pace, basically. Yeah. It's only, like, an hour and a half long, too.
Yeah, it definitely moves. And, you know, it's funny, because when I suggested this film, I wasn't sure if you would be interested. Because, like I said, we've never really watched a pure action film before. And we've talked about it before, but you're sort of a film novice.
Right.
So, what were your impressions of watching this film just from, like, someone who's not kind of as seeped in, like, movie culture as I am?
Now that I've watched all these different movies and stuff, and you kind of see what works and kind of see what doesn't work, and you kind of see what happens. And one of the things I really liked was you cannot take away Brandon Lee's like charisma.
He's so charismatic in this, yeah.
Especially, I mean, he was just so good. But some of the dialogue is kind of cheesy.
Yeah.
It was a real kind of like cheesy love song. I mean, and I can sort of pick it apart from some of the bad, you know, bad moments. But what made it work for me was just not the pace, but the fact that the action movie, it was complicated. The plot was complicated enough to follow. So the MacGuffin that we always talk about, it kept you reeled in. There wasn't too many subplots to sort of chase around or sort of like wonder what's going to happen. I mean, you can almost pretty much guess what's going to happen. And if it doesn't happen the way that you think, it happens very sort of similarly.
To me, the best action films are very direct. I mean, it's the action films should not be twisty turny.
Right.
They should be like simple roller coasters, like ups and downs, the occasional lull before the exciting part.
Yeah.
They should be very direct.
Right, because basically the surprises are just the different challenges in like what I call like the battle scenes. Yeah. You know, like, oh, I dropped the gun, I gotta get the gun from this guy, or I gotta battle this guy, or I gotta, you know, jump over this guy so this guy gets shot and you know, whatever, you know.
And it's really the beauty of the choreography and the movement. In a lot of ways it's action films like that, even movies with a lot of gun battles, to me, have a rhythm to it that almost made me think of like musicals.
Okay.
And like in movies that have like dance choreography.
I mean, that is getting connoisseurish.
Yeah, well, because I mean, it's about the joy in watching kinetic movement.
Okay.
And like, I mean, because if you think about that's what watching martial arts is. That's what watching what Rocky films is. You're kind of getting joy out of watching, you know, the human body do interesting things.
Well, I mean, it is kind of watching like a ballet.
It very much is, yeah.
Because even though that it is scripted, or this guy's going to do this, and it was really sort of like, you know, one guy take a turn kind of, you know, kung fu-ish, right?
That's one of the tropes. Yeah, all the guys just kind of wait until one guy gets his butt kicked, and then his cow run up.
Yeah, they never take on like two guys or one or three.
It took them a while to figure that choreography out. Yeah. You see that in movies now. They figure out ways to handle that and make it seem realistic. But back then, they still kind of struggled with the idea of how to fight multiple guys.
Yeah. But there is a lot of up-close sort of action, but it shows it from, you know, Brandon Lee's sort of perspective. And he has just wonderful, wonderful choreography.
Yeah,
to watch him move is so fluid.
Yeah, he did a lot of Wing Chun in this, which is a style of kung fu that has to do with close quarters movements and blocking. It was actually the martial art his father studied when he was young, and Brandon actually did the fight choreography in the film himself. So that's part of the reason why it looks so good and it seems so suited for him.
Right.
Was he actually helped map it out, which is pretty unusual for the start of the film to actually do their own choreography.
But I remember when he's in the his own, he's in like the safe house, right?
Yeah.
And then he's supposed to like, but the FBI guys turn out to like they're gonna actually kill him because they're you know they're being hired by the first bad guy.
Yeah.
So they're hired by Serrano, basically. They work for him. And, so, but there's one scene where he goes to hide in the bedroom and he climbs up in the closet and like he lifts himself up and like his feet go first. And it's just like, you know, it's almost like he's underwater.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like they want to show you how much of a specimen he was.
Yeah. Like that's so like, graceful.
Like, look at how nice he moves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's like he is his own special effect, and that's true of the best action stars. I think
right.
is they don't need like CGI or anything like that to be impressive. You know, they're physical specimens. They're talented. They have a great movement,
right?
And usually they're very very in shape.
And I don't want to take anything away from you know his acting either, because I think that, you know, some people might dismiss his acting. There's not a lot of, he doesn't have a whole lot of lines in the movie.
No, he doesn't.
He very plays off kind of a very sort of standoffish kind of character, which is, I mean, it's really probably easy to play, to he's be, a, you know, sort of sarcastic.
He's almost and, a little bit snotty, yeah.
Yeah, and just kind of be like, I don't want to be here.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of an easy motion to portray. Yeah. But there was a scene I really particularly liked where he has to, like, near the end, when they're trying to catch the final, like, Asian henchman guy, and they're trying to figure out where this, you know, drug drop is going to be, and it's going to be at this laundromat. So they stake out the laundromat, and he goes in and he disguises himself as a person who works in the laundromat. Yeah. And he has to go from, like, being the disguise, like, acting, you know, you're acting and acting, right? Yes. I mean, you're like,
yeah, you're acting like you're acting.
Yeah, know? Right. Yeah. And you have to be good at it. But how he goes in and out of it, how you watch it from a viewer's perspective and see the character, you know, go from acting to not acting.
Yeah. But even though he's actually acting,
he's acting, acting the whole time, right? Yeah. You know, it's kind of a weird sort of mind trick, but to do that, you really see him do that very clearly. Yeah. You see him kind of dawn on this character, but he doesn't do it too much. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I mean, it almost is really believable. You're almost like, no. Wow.
He's like, really good at that scene. Yeah. I think the entire movie shows the best way for me to sum up rapid fire to people is it's fun, but really it shows the raw potential that Brandon Lee would have. And he had so much charisma, so much raw talent that really wouldn't get really seen until the next year when he started filming The Crow.
Right.
And so I think that's actually a pretty good segue into the next film. I was really, in a lot of ways, Rapid Fire is kind of like the test drive for what he would do later on.
Right. Right, right, right. Yeah, I would definitely agree. It was kind of, you know, everything is sort of building up to this. Like, you got to walk sort of before, or you got to crawl before you can walk, right? Yeah. Like, and so we'll, I mean, so as far, I mean, the ending, the perfect, I mean, I can see why it's, you know, maybe not quite as popular. I can see some other characters playing it. Yeah. Like, if you put, you know, Steven Seagal, or you put, you know, Van Damme, or somebody, if like, if you put Van Damme, you know, in this, it would be,
and no one would care about it.
Well, no one would care about it. It would be a lot cheesier.
Yeah.
It would be produced like really terribly. There would be more horrible acting in it, like all around, because it would have just been much more of a lower budget film.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, there might have been some other subplots and some other things that producers would have thrown in there to make it more interesting.
And
this one just gets like right to the point. Yeah. It's kind of like reading like a dime store, you know, kind of like, you know, novel, like, you know, like some sort of...
It's like a 100-page little, like, page-turner. And part of the reason why the movie works so well is just again because Brandon's so naturally charismatic. And you slot any other actor in there, which that you could, the movie gets exponentially worse.
Well, and I to me, I thought the biggest sort of distraction, I mean, as much as, you know, Powers Booth, I thought he was just slightly overacting.
He is.
You know, a lot of
times. He's chewing the scenery in this, yeah.
Oh, my gosh,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
And it almost makes me think, is he trying to, like, take scenes away or take things away? You know what I mean?
I think he just didn't know quite how to modulate himself, maybe, because he felt like he had to, like, because, you know, the kid was new. He maybe felt like he had to. Yeah. To do it a little bit to carry it. But you're right. He's a little over the top. He chews the scenery a little bit. Like, he's so gruff, it's almost comical. Yeah.
Yeah, and just the way he delivers his lines is so sort of tongue-in-cheek. And
Yeah.
It's just a little too much. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he's acting. Like, yeah. You know, like, in every scene, you're like, oh, he's acting so hard right now. You know?
But see, that's the kind of thing that I notice now. You know what I mean? I might just watch that movie and be like, "Oh yeah, this movie's good," or whatever. I mean, I wouldn't know. I wouldn't be able to tell you why or tell you what's wrong with this movie. Yeah. What would you do to make it better?
To me, that's what's so fun to me about this show is getting to see your journey as you become more of an uber nerd like me.
Well, I'm not. I mean, well, one thing I will say before we move on to The Crow, I don't think that. That you necessarily have to, you know, see these kind of things to enjoy the movie. And I don't want people to think that, oh, I have to, like, notice the pacing of the movie or notice the acting or notice the scenery or, like, the plots or whatever to really enjoy it. I mean, that's just, like, part of it. And I think it just – once you watch enough, like, it just becomes sort of natural.
Yeah,
like
you don't think about it. It's just part of the background process of how you absorb the film.
Right.
Like
if you just like listening to music, somebody may be not able to tell like all the instruments from each other, but eventually you start picking apart all those little instruments, and then pretty soon you're like listening to King Crimson and going, "Oh my gosh! Like listen to all this is what's just going on right now."
Yeah.
You know,
I gotta say, I love that you referenced King Crimson for that. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, that's gotta be like one of the most nerdiest bands ever. So,
it truly is, and I love it, man.
I'm a King Crimson fan right here. Yeah. So.
Well, and you know, King Crimson probably would have worked pretty well on the soundtrack for The Crow.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
All right, so moving on to The Crow. So The Crow, completely different type of movie, completely different style, completely different type of movie. It's very action. It has a very high death count.
Yeah. It's actiony, but it's almost like a gothic romance.
Yeah. It's like a gothic noir, like romance, like revenge.
Yeah. Action film.
Yes.
Yeah. It's definitely a hybrid movie. And in 1994, when this came out, there was nothing like it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was 13 years old when this came out. I saw this in the theater because I liked comics. And this was based on a comic. And it blew my mind.
Okay.
I'll go ahead and say a confession. This is the movie that made me fall in love with going to the movie theater. I saw this movie 3 times that year.
Okay.
And enjoyed it.
So wait. The comic came out when you were like 13, right?
The comic came out when I was younger. I discovered it about that same year the movie came out, but it had been out for a while.
Right. But, I mean, the movie came out in 1994. You weren't 13 in 94.
I may have been 14.
You had to be older than that.
Probably
like a year younger than me.
I'm actually like 4 years old. Younger. Yeah, we can talk about this offline. But
never mind.
I
know how old you were. SRA, you're lying to me.
I'll be 40 this year.
Oh, okay. All right. All right, that's fair.
So now people can stalk us on. We've given away too much personal information. Right. But yeah, so I was a young teenager.
Okay.
And I had never seen a film like this. Music, the way it was shot, it blew my mind. And I wasn't the only kid whose mind it blew. This movie was huge in 94. It was such a big deal.
I want to call it like some sort of like noir film. It's almost like superhero noir,
It definitely
or maybe
is
comic book hero noir.
It's definitely influenced
like that.
The style of it's definitely influenced by those movies.
Yeah,
I mean it's influenced by old movies and the way it looks. If you look at the artwork for the comic, you can see the influence in like the grays and the deep shadows and stuff like that.
Well, the plot line is very simple.
It's
in The
Crow. Super simple.
Eric Draven, who's played by Brandon Lee. You know, he and his girlfriend are killed by these
gangsters, basically.
Yeah, these bad gangster guys.
These colorful gangsters with really goofy nicknames.
Yeah, because all they're trying to do is take over the building. The slumlord, you know, doing the slumlord's like laundry, basically, by getting rid of the tenants, and winds up falling from. You know, they just came up there to, like, scare him.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, Eric comes in and then, like, winds up, like, falling from... Getting shot and falling from the
window,
the
yeah.
Window, thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And he dies.
Yeah, and he dies. A year later, he comes back to life to avenge he and his girlfriend's, like, murder.
Yeah. Yeah, basically, he's, like, a vengeful spirit.
Right. And when I say come back to life, it's not like, you know, you always have to explain, like, the supernatural, right? He is supernatural in the fact that he can't die.
Yeah.
He
can't even really be hurt.
No. And but he can interact with everyone. He's like a real sort of person. Yeah.
He's like an invincible like person. He's not a zombie because he's not rotting, but he's not alive, and he can't, and if he gets hurt, he immediately heals.
Right.
And
his power sort of. We'll get to the end and talk about that, like, kind of like, along with this crow.
Yeah. Yeah, so basically, they call it the crow because this bird, the movie opens with a narration, which I'm sure many of you will be familiar with, that talks about how, in some cultures, they believe a crow carries your spirit to the land of the dead. And if you have a tragedy so great in your life, the crow can bring you back to right those injustices. Okay. So the crow basically... appears at Eric's grave, and Eric basically climbs out of his own grave looking like the day he died, basically. Just perfect.
Yeah. And he kind of, you know, has this... The whole sort of opening of the movie is you know, that whole... the kind of like the... you know, kind of like the death scene. You just, like, the cops are there, kind of like right after, basically, and they're surveying the scene. And then, like, kind of like, you know, Eric sort of climbing out of the grave. Ernie Hudson plays the cop.
Yeah, the cop who kind of finds him and works the case.
The other, like, the kind of the neighbor sort of girl who's probably about, like, 12 or 13 years old, named Sarah, and the Rochelle Davis.
Rochelle Davis, yeah. She was basically the kid that Brandon, that Eric and Shelley kind of babysat. So she was, like, their neighbor. Friend of the family kind of thing. She actually narrates the film.
Right.
And one of the ways, that's one of the devices they use to kind of patch over the holes in the film once Brandon Lee unfortunately passed away before the movie was done.
Yeah. So, but he comes back to life, basically, or comes back out of the grave, whatever you want to say, with these superhuman powers just to kill everybody that was sort of involved with he and his girlfriend's death. I mean, and it's really like what's sort of driving it is that you get like through... Eric Draven, you know, talks about his girlfriend and like he has flashbacks. And one of the first thing he does is go to the pawn shop to get his old, you know, engagement ring.
The whole movie is very elemental. It's not meant to be a real plot heavy film. It's about the idea of love and grief and anger when that love is taken from you.
But
he goes to the pawn shop. Yeah, let's actually get to the plot a little bit.
Well, the whole city, you know, is just like it rains all the time.
Yeah.
You get the idea. It's like this really sort of Hell's Kitchen, seedy kind of city where it's just, you know, rock and roll and noise and just like not a place where you want to like raise kids. Yeah,
it seems like the sun never comes out. I think the sun only shows in one scene in the entire film, and in that point, the character is indoors, and it's just used to frame someone in shadow.
Mm-hmm.
But say he goes to the pawn shop, and at that point, to basically get the ring back for his lost love, and he runs into one of the greatest character actors of any film. The great Joe, is it Polito, I believe is how you pronounce
it? Yes, Joe Polito. Yeah, plays Gideon, which is, I don't know where they get his name, like the, you know, the Gideon.
That's in the original comic. But Joe Polito, he was in Night Court. He was the handyman in Night Court.
Yep.
He was in The Man Who Wasn't There.
Yep.
He was in a bunch of Coen Brother movies, actually.
Right.
Really memorable character actor. He basically, you know, gets killed by Brandon Lee in a fun little scene where you get to see Brandon Lee monologue and say and really cool cryptic things.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, the movie is very simple.
Yeah.
Basically, Eric goes through and finds each of these colorful bad guys.
Yeah.
And just kills them.
Right.
And he does it in different ways. Sometimes it's a fight scene. Sometimes it's a car chase. Sometimes he just blows them up.
Well, yeah. I mean, he killed the guy with the knives because that's the way he kills other people.
Yes.
He killed the guy, like, blew his car up because that's what his job was to blow things up.
And speaking of the guy he blew up in the car, that was a good play by an actor named David Patrick Kelly, who was a great character actor, who was the bad guy in The Warriors. Warriors come out to play. Yeah, I'm doing the finger thing. You guys can't see it, but yeah.
With that, the little Coke bottle.
Yeah, but that's him grown up. That's okay.
Oh wow!
Yeah, go back and look at the scene. It looks like once you know it, you'll see it.
Right.
But that's him. That's him as a grown man, as a T-Bird.
Right, T-Bird. Yeah.
But yeah, it's a very dark movie, but it's really nice to look at. It's directed by a guy named Alex Proyas,
right,
who made a lot of music videos. The whole movie looks very gothic, but very slick at the same time.
Right. I think that is one of the biggest takeaways of the movie is just the look and the feel of the film and how it sort of is this dark, ominous place. But then, you know, you have this sort of like superhero vengeful death. So there's like a, you know, action and a super mysteriousness around it and around like death. And that's why I think it gained a lot of popularity because it hit a lot of points. Because it is like death and morbid, but it's all like on a, you know, for good reasons, right?
It's
like
all about, it's all about love, but it's dark, but it's romantic. I tell you, every girl I knew from age 13 to 20, every girl was obsessed with this movie. Yeah, I mean, it hit a chord with people. Yeah. And some of that was because Brandon Lee died and it was publicized before the film came out.
Yeah.
That was part of the reason why it was successful. But it wouldn't have been successful if it wasn't really good and it had deeper themes.
Well, people also kind of thought maybe they'll find it, you know, they'll spot the scene that he died in or whatever.
Yeah. And
because there are a lot of scenes because he doesn't die, he can just like take on a bullet and absorb it. There are a lot of points in the movie where he gets shot at. I mean,
I'll tell you a funny story about me watching it for the first time in the theater. I saw it with my best friend at the time, and we were 13, 14. I'm not sure of the exact age anymore. You made me doubt myself.
All right.
But my friend was watching it, and we had heard the stories. So literally every time Brandon Lee got shot, this is so terrible. Every time Brandon Lee got shot, my friend would be like, I think that's where he died. I'm like, no, it's not, man. Be quiet.
Well, maybe we should stop to explain that for a second.
Yeah, let's get serious for a moment and talk about the tragedy. I mean, it's been well talked about, but for the people who may not know,
when I first heard about this, you hear about, oh, you know, there were blanks, and then like, but somehow he still got shot. Like it was, you know, the prop person didn't do the correct thing. One thing, I did a lot of reading on this, and you probably know because you've probably done more extensive reading than myself.
I'm a huge fan of this movie, yeah.
So I'll try to explain it in more my sort of simple understanding of it.
Sure.
Is that, you know, for close-up scenes, they will use where you can actually see the bullet. Like in a revolver where you actually see, you know, that there's a bullet in the chamber, they will use a different sort of blank round. And what they'll do is they'll take a bullet that and they'll take the actual lead shot out, but they leave like the jacket on basically. And so they put the jacket back on. So it's just like this kind of like a sleeve, just like an empty and it still has a primer and a fire in it. So when it fires, it does actually fire like a blank. I mean, it's still a blank. And if that thing comes out, I mean, it doesn't really come out with a, you know, like a bullet because it's not attached to anything.
Yes.
Like there's hardly any weight. Like it's supposed to just like kind of fall out. Well, sometimes because it's metal and metal like bends when it gets hot, sometimes they get lodged in the barrel. And then when they go to like the regular scenes where they're going to like, oh, we're just going to shoot blanks where there's nothing in them, those actually are a lot louder. They have like four times the amount or three times the amount of like primer and gunpowder to just basically make a loud, you know, noise basically. And, you know, there's actually a real puff of air basically from that explosion that comes out. Well, if you don't clear And that lodge, that little piece, that little shard gets stuck in there, it can come out with almost the same force as a bullet can.
And that's what happened. The actor fired the gun at Brandon Lee, and it knocked the blank out of the barrel. And it was at such close range, it acted like a real bullet and hit him in the abdomen.
Right.
They immediately realized what happened. They got him into a hospital, into surgery, and sadly he passed away during surgery.
Yeah, because there was a Brandon Lee had a blood pack, so the blank was supposed to go off, and then the blood pack was supposed to just fire. So usually when you have a blood pack, there's a button that the actor who's wearing the blood pack pushes that electronically like fires off like whatever happens. So they have to pay attention to what's happening so that like everything can happen sort of at once.
Yeah.
But the actor who was wearing the blood pack has control. But what happens when he shot him, it shot him like right in the blood pack. So
took him a minute to realize what happened. Yeah.
So unfortunately, he was rushed to the hospital and did not make it. So
yeah, it's what to me, especially with watching these two films, it's such a tragedy, man, because he would have been a big star.
It would have been. Now, there was 3 days left of shooting. A lot of the scenes that they had left to shoot were the scenes that were the flashback scenes in the apartment. So these were like the fighting scenes. These were the scenes that where he's getting out of the grave and like walking. So all of those like sort of intro scenes and all of those sort of like flashback scenes. And
I've got some interesting trivia about that once we get to the trivia section.
So, but yeah, I think that like there are a lot of movies that I can see when I watch it that basically sort of influenced sort of after this. There was never sort of a movie that was this dark.
Yeah.
And I don't mean like dark, like I watch it and it was, it's not a really bright scene. I mean, like the subject matter was so, so dark and sort of morbid.
It's a morbid film, but it's, again, it's such a weird alchemy because it's morbid, but it's about love. So you feel kind of romantic quality to it. And I think all that mixed together really caused people to fall in love with it. And on top of that, it had an amazing soundtrack. I mean, it was almost like a snapshot of all the bands that were great during that time period who played heavier music. Like as much as the the Empire Records album from last episode did not feel like the 90s to me.
No. Because it had like Dishwalla. And
I love how we always reference Dishwalla as the band that's not good. But but like this, the Crow soundtrack, to me that is like, mid-90s hard rock. And we'll get into the bands on it later. But the soundtrack, the visuals, and Brandon's really wonderful performance and his iconic look, like he paints his face like a Grim Reaper kind of death mask thing,
right?
And it's just so iconic looking. He's got this long hair and this cool black jacket, and he's got like tape holding his shirt together, and he looks like he should be in the best band ever.
I mean, it really is sort of like when I told you that I thought I'd seen this movie, but apparently I hadn't. I don't know what movie I thought I saw.
I don't know what movie you get confused with this one.
I don't know. You have to remember, 1994 for me was a lot different than your 1994.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't have a lot going on at 14 years old.
I was like a freshman in college, so I was discovering a lot more things, a lot more different things than like going to the movies.
I'd get there. Right?
All right. So yeah, they're probably, during that time. But anyway, so, my point being is that, what was I going to say? That not only was it dark, it influenced a lot of movies and, movies that would then come later, like The Matrix, like,
Blade and X-Men and really,
but still, oh no, I know what I was going to say. Brandon Lee, it's almost like, it took us about to, whatever the Batman that had, the Joker.
The Dark Knight?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it was that sort of dark. Even dark. I mean, somewhat darker than that because, the characters are a lot seedier.
Well, and I tell you, The Crow stylistically influenced every kind of fantasy comic book action film that came after it up until The Dark Knight, which also had another tragic death, and then those movies started being more influenced by The Dark Knight. But for like a 10-12 year period, like so many action films, science fiction, fantasy action films, were heavily influenced by The Crow.
Well, I say it's also influenced, but I also say greenlighted.
Yeah.
You know, because you, I mean, to me, it's like nobody would have thought about The Matrix until like this movie came out. Well, it's they, like, oh, we got a Dark City movie? Okay, we got this.
Yeah. Well,
like,
I definitely think Blade.
Yeah, Blade, yeah.
The X-Men films.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of those things would not have existed. Hugely influential film.
Right.
Hugely influential.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and there's just so much cool stuff in it. Like, I mean, the script is way better than Rapid Fire as far as the dialogue goes. There's so many little iconic lines in The Crow. I mean, it can't rain all the time. What a great line is that.
Yeah.
Victims aren't we all, you know?
Oh, yeah.
You know? And there's just so many great lines in... I don't want to...
What was the one that he said to Ernie Hudson? Well, I want to say Ernie... I say Ernie Hudson... Sergeant Albrecht?
Officer Albrecht, yeah.
Officer or Sergeant Albrecht. He says, nothing is trivial or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to think everything was trivial. Nothing is trivial.
Nothing is trivial.
Yeah.
That was an ad-lib line, by the way.
And his acting in that scene, when he goes and has like his little powwow with the cop in his apartment, in the cop's apartment, it's just Brandon just being it feels very real.
Yeah.
Just a very nice little moment of character acting. And it's really kind of hard. It makes you want to well up a little bit because you don't see the character there. You really see Brandon Lee.
Well, I know, but that was my point. I was trying to get to is that he dawned on this character of the Crow, you know, a lot like the way that. And I'm bad at actors' names again. You'll have to help me out in The Dark Knight.
Christian Heath Ledger as the Joker.
Christian Bale.
Sorry, man.
God.
Okay. Heath Ledger as the Joker.
Yes.
And it's funny because a lot of those people who were obsessed with the Crow for years and years kind of moved that obsession over to Heath Ledger's the Joker later on. And I tell you, I'm convinced that Heath Ledger's Joker visually was inspired by the Crow. Because of the way the makeup and the way the makeup was done on the Joker, the long hair, the way he wore his clothes. There's a little bit of Crow influence in there. There definitely, as you can see, they echo each other a little bit.
The way
bit.
He sort of talks to the other people that he's trying to
get. It's definitely in there.
Yeah. But, I mean, the Joker definitely a lot more seedier, a lot more
It's just, it's
a lot more darker and dirtier.
There's like little hints of it. But I don't want to skip over one thing. The main villain in this film is a great character actor named Michael Wincott.
Yep.
The big mafia boss.
Yes.
Name is Top Dollar.
Top Dollar. I mean, that's the kind of the characters. Let's just go through the different Top Dollar, Skank, 1010, Fun Boy,
and T-Bird. Yeah. At one point, Brandon Lee calls them Jolly Pirate nicknames. But yeah, Michael Wincott he plays the big boss, but he wears immaculate suits. He talks in a ridiculous Southern accent. Every man's got a devil boy. Yeah, as my father said to me when I was a kid, and it should be ridiculous, but Michael Wincott's got this great gravelly voice, and it just works, and he's such a good villain, and I wish Michael Wincott had been in more movies. He was in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. He was in Alien 4.
But I mean, he's almost as like his character is almost as dawned, you know, on as Eric Draven. You know what I mean? Sort of comic book-ish.
Yeah.
Where everybody else is kind of like regular folks. I mean, there's some comic book-ish, you know, in some of the other villains. Yeah,
he's larger than life for sure. Like, to the point where he doesn't get blown off the screen by what Brandon Lee's doing. Like, he actually stands toe-to-toe with him from like a character standpoint. Like, they're both interesting in different ways.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Yeah. And he is he's so cool. And I wish he had been, like, he still acts a little bit, but he does not do much stuff. And sadly, he was never in anything as good as this. But Michael Wincott is so good in this. I could not let us go on without saying how great I think he is.
I would agree. And in this movie, he plays a fantastic villain.
Yeah,
such a soft-spoken, you know, but just like ominous sort of villain. And he's trying to like figure it all out. He's like, he's still like sort of in doubt. Like, this can't happen. Like, this guy can't just come back to life, you know, or whatever.
And what I love is even when he finally accepts it, he's not all that upset about it. He's like, oh, okay, some sort of zombie whatever.
Well, I mean, all of the characters like that. I find that very interesting about this, you know, movie, too. And I know that's part of, like, the writing is, like, nobody's really sort of, you know, surprised or taken aback. Like, I was waiting for, like, Sergeant Albrecht to be like, what in the world? But, you know, once he starts putting two and two together, that, like, this person that he saw on the street is also, you know, the guy he saw dead a year ago.
Like, there's only one where he's like, are you some kind of ghost?
And they have that's it.
Yeah, and then he has the brain lays like from where he goes boo, you know. Yeah, and that's how, that's really the only way they address it.
Right,
and it'd be weird in a movie that wasn't so heavily stylized, but this movie is so stylized, it just you should accept it that they would accept it,
right?
Because it's not reality.
No.
It doesn't feel anything like reality. What it feels like is this cool hyper reality where everyone wears black leather and goes to really cool like rock bars,
right?
You know,
and like has guns and you know, swallows bullets and, and shooters. Yeah. Like, it's like what?
Yeah.
So, I mean, a fantastic movie, fantastic ending. We'll talk a little bit about the editing, the creative editing that they had to do since Brandon Lee wasn't around. Like we, I talked about it before. Yeah. How he was missing like three scenes, and you were telling me, and we'll just go ahead and mention it now, because I didn't really keep it in my notes for the trivia. And I don't think we should really save it, but there were some things taken out, and there was like there was even like a character that was missing.
There's a lot of things over there were kind of cut out to make it work. They kind of had, but they didn't quite have all the connective tissue to put it together. And in the original version of the movie, the crow was not the thing that linked Eric to the world of the living. He was actually followed around by a Grim Reaper figure. He looked like the Grim Reaper, but he, instead of wearing like a robe and having a scythe, he wore a cowboy outfit, like a gothic cowboy outfit. But he had a skull face.
Right.
And he would talk to him like, kind of like a redneck. He'd be like, boy, you need to come home and finish this. And it was played by a guy named Michael Berryman, who plays one of the mutants in Weird Science.
Okay.
Bald guy with kind of a pointy head, stubby fingers, in a ton of horror films.
Yeah.
They filmed most of his scenes. I think part of the reason why they cut it, it didn't look that good. Like, it looked a little cheesy. Like, imagine this guy in like a skull mask trying to be ominous.
Right.
It almost took it too far into being cartoony.
Okay.
But if you go on the internet, you can find these clips. And they changed it because they didn't have all the scenes for it. And the stuff didn't quite work that well, so they took it out and made basically the bird the link to the afterlife, which is to me is more elegant. It's simpler.
Yeah. I mean, and it's kind of funny how we talked about this a little bit in our pre-production. I found it interesting too that like Eric never really acknowledges that the bird, even there, doesn't talk to it, doesn't hold it in its hand. You know, doesn't even look at it.
Yeah, the bird's just nearby, which I always thought was kind of cool.
I think he looks at it like once, like he's following it.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah, at the very beginning when he's still trying to figure out what's happening, he acknowledges it. That's the only time he does it. After that, it's like he accepts it after that, and it's just this thing that's there near him.
Right.
Which to me, it creates really cool visuals. Like the bird's just kind of there in the background or flying past him.
Right.
You know? Like, the movie's full of just iconic, cool shots. And the bird's a lot of that. It's the bird just kind of swooping in and, like resting on something.
There was one scene that I was like, what is happening? And it was when he goes to, you know, avenge, what's his name, the Fun Boy.
Fun Boy, yeah.
And, you know, he's got the girl with him who's like, you know, Sarah's mom or whatever. And they're doing drugs and like they're doing cocaine and heroin or morphine. I don't know what it was.
It's movie drugs.
Movie drugs. Yeah. It was like something that it was, you know,
injected.
Some sort of syringe in her arm or whatever. So he takes the guy. He like already like shoots him and like puts him in the bathtub. And she's like just cowering over in the, you know, in the corner, like, don't touch me. And he like grabs her and like puts her in front of the mirror, says some like crazy things and like squeeze her arm and like all the drugs come out.
Yeah, the drug. He says, mother is the name of God on the lips of every child or something like that, which again is a great line.
Right.
But
it's
yeah.
one of these sort of like, you know, biblical sort of, you know. Yeah.
And yeah. It's one of those things where he just has the powers that the scene needed to bring the point across, you know. In the comic book, he basically is just an unstoppable force of, like, righteousness.
Yeah, and that's where I was kind of like, you know, you start questioning what sort of other superhuman superpowers that he has or whatever. I just thought it was a little too much. I mean, even my wife was like, did he just squeeze her arm and all the drugs came out? Yeah. I was like, yeah.
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 And they never really explain it. And,
no.
And it is a little weird. But yeah. Again, I just go with it, you know. It's the point is he's trying to basically save his, because the girl that's there is the mother of the daughter of the girl he babysat.
Right.
So he's basically trying to save her life by proxy.
Right.
Because again, he's just this righteous. Almost, he's really like a gothic angel in a lot of ways.
Right.
Well,
and I thought it was funny too, because you see, like at the end of the movie, she's just like completely, you know, turned her life around. Like,
yeah.
Is making like frying egg, you know, making breakfast and like eggs and bacon for her daughter.
Sorry, I was a junkie for your entire childhood. Anybody here have some eggs?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
maybe she should have been in that TV show Mom or something. Yeah. Like that.
But again, because it's almost a fairy tale.
Yeah.
And that's why to me it works. It doesn't feel jarring or too out of place.
Right.
Because it's not, again, it goes back to it's not reality.
Right.
It's not even trying to be reality. It's a gothic fairy tale.
That's a good way to put it. A gothic noir.
And with gunfights and the occasional kung fu punch.
That's maybe it's a noir fairy tale.
There you go. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's go through some of the facts, the tidbits, the stuff.
Let's talk about the soundtrack for a minute.
Oh, well, we're talking about the soundtrack when I get to all this other stuff. It was a great alternative rock soundtrack.
It is.
Which I'll get to. All right. All right, you'll have to stay tuned for the rest of the podcast. By the way, The Crow is on Netflix right now, at least at the moment of this recording of this podcast, which is only, you know, weeks before we actually release it, so hopefully it'll still be out.
Yeah. If you haven't seen it, I recommend both these films. You really should see The Crow if you haven't. There are very few modern classics. Right. It's a modern classic. It's just so influential. But anyway, let's get into the tidbits and trivia.
So, because, I mean, Brandon Lee only did like five movies. So, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Brandon Lee for Rapid Fire. Brandon Lee originally wanted Hong Kong director John Woo to direct the film.
Yeah. He was a big fan of Hong Kong movies.
Yeah.
I'll go tell you a little bit of, I guess, some trivia about this related. Because we haven't talked about this, but I am a huge Hong Kong film fan.
Yes.
If you follow our website, our actual like written website, I posted an article or two about Asian film. One of my true passions is Hong Kong film. Brandon Lee obviously liked it too. So some of the action sequences in Rapid Fire are actually taken from popular Hong Kong films.
Okay.
Almost like beat for beat.
Really?
And it's a little bit of theft, but it's really more of an homage.
Okay.
And one of the ones he took from, I'm going to recommend for this episode, so I'm not going to say which one it is yet.
Okay.
But the fact that when he fires the two guns and he does a lot of the glass breaking, that's very John Woo-esque type of stuff.
Okay.
So the action scenes in Rapid Fire are very Hong Kong-esque.
Okay. So, John Woo, the studio, wanted a martial arts film rather than the type of films John Woo made.
It's mostly shooting guys with two guns. That was John Woo's thing.
So, yeah.
If you've ever seen Hard Target, you've seen Face Off, the classic Hard Boiled. It's all two guys with guns. It's all two guns and a
Mission Impossible.
Mission Impossible 2?
2, yeah.
Yeah, easily the most silly of all the Mission Impossibles, but it's still pretty good.
I guess they didn't have room in the budget for doves.
No, you're right. There are no doves in Rapid Fire. There probably should have been
another like John Woo.
Yeah, there should have been. I'm surprised there weren't doves.
All right.
Pigeons, maybe.
Sorry, this is a joke about John Woo.
Yeah, he loves his doves for sure.
All right. So Brandon Lee broke a toe during filming while kicking a large oak door. And it's so much so that his foot swelled up like a watermelon. It stopped filming for the day. And however, the scene was never included in the film.
That's crappy.
It's like it broke a foot for like nothing, basically. It's not even in the film.
It is Jackie Chan moment, and they didn't even use it. Yeah.
Some of his other scenes were cut. Some lobby cards and theatrical and TV trailers show parts of a deleted fight scene in an army office between Jake and a couple of soldiers after he tries to steal files about his dead father.
Huh. I've seen the trailer. I've never seen those. I'll just try to track those down.
So, yeah, I'm surprised you don't know about that. But no, I mean, I guess, you know, hit the subplot about his father, right? You know, was this subplot. And I guess that they were like, you know, and that's one of the things that we didn't mention in the previously, but that's one of the ways that the girl like tries to get him more interested in what's going on. Like, I've got files about your father. And like, he's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. His father was a democracy protester at Tiananmen Square and was killed during the protest.
Right.
I mean, it's not a super important subplot for the movie to make sense, but it is a little bit of shading. I think they cut it out so the movie would just keep, again, propelling forward.
Yeah. I mean, and they already drew enough sort of parallels of about, you know, him and like, Ryan and like, you know, his dad or whatever, how they were kind of like in the same way and like, whatever. So there was a list of people that were considered for the role of Mace Ryan. I'll just go through all of them.
Oh, no, this I don't know either. So I'm curious to hear this.
I don't know. This is on IMDb. And look, when I say considered, I mean that they probably sent it over to them just to see if they were interested. And they said no. Or they might have even talked about it, like, maybe we should get this person. No, you know, next. Like
considered can mean
so
a lot.
So considered can mean a lot of things, right? Alec Baldwin, Jeff Bridges, James Caan, Kevin Costner, Robert De Niro, Michael Douglas, Harrison Ford, Richard Gere, Jeff Goldblum, Mark Harmon, Don Johnson, Michael Keaton, Harvey Keitel, Al Pacino, Christopher Lambert, Matthew Modine, Val Kilmer, Michael Norrie, Alan Rickman, Kurt Russell, John Saxon, and Tom Selleck.
That literally is every actor who could have been at the time. John Saxon is interesting because John Saxon was in Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee. He played the white guy in Enter the Dragon. But the one name I got to comment on is just imagine like Jeff Goldblum in this movie.
That's right.
Just being all Goldblum-y, you know.
Oh my god! I don't think he wants to really. I can't even imagine him holding a gun in his hand.
I can't either. I can't imagine Goldblum.
So
being,
I have this gun.
Yeah, it makes me shoot. It makes me nervous. I don't really like it.
Yeah, I was like, what? Yeah. Anyway, this is a really bad Goldblum impression. Yeah. I'm sorry. For the role of Carla Withers, here's another big list: Kim Basinger, Jennifer Beals, Lorraine Bracco, Kate Capshaw, Jamie Lee Curtis, Jodie Foster, Melanie Griffith, Mariel Hemingway, Madonna, Michelle Pfeiffer, Sharon Stone, Uma Thurman, Sean Young, and Marissa Tomei.
They were aiming high for those.
No doubt.
Yeah.
No doubt.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I know. Why don't they just throw Jennifer Tilly in there, too? Like, why not?
Everyone, especially every other actress who was big at the time. Yeah.
All right. So, all right. Moving on. Powers Booth and Raymond J. Barry also went head-to-head in action movie Sudden Death in 1995.
Which is a very fun action movie starring Van Damme, who we've mentioned a couple times on this. Sudden Death is like Die Hard in a hockey arena.
Ah, okay.
I know it sounds stupid.
Yeah.
It's surprisingly good. It's probably one of Van Damme's best movies.
Right. And we mentioned before Al Long. How do you pronounce his
Long.
Name?
Long. Because he's also known as Al Kabong Long.
Oh, okay. He's best known for playing henchmen, often die in American action films.
It's true.
He said, though, that his favorite on-screen death of a character that he portrayed was in Rapid Fire.
Oh, that's cool.
Well, I mean, really, they have a scene, you know, that's a really elaborate, like, sort of fight scene.
Yeah, they've got a nice kung fu scene, where him and Brandon square off each other, and they get to do some nice choreography.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I mean, he was one of his most formidable opponents before he had to, like, fight the other guy. You know?
He was like the underboss.
Yeah, he's like the number two guy.
Yeah.
The number two boss before you got to fight the number one boss. Yeah. The final body count is 34, just if you're keeping score.
Some people do that. There's a whole like subculture of movie fans who love to know body counts in action films.
Yeah, not very high, but I mean, if you consider everybody that does, there are some henchmen and stuff like that, I'm sure. But anyway, it debuted at number 3 at the box office.
Not terrible.
Right, but part of the popularity was because of Brandon Crowe.
Yeah, it's right. Because
Brandon Lee's death.
It came out, yeah, because it came out right. Yeah, it actually came out as he was filming The Crow when it came out. You're right. I had forgotten that he had passed away before even Rapid Fire had come out. I had forgotten that.
So even though that it was filmed in, it was 1992, it was released like later in 92, but like it was out, and then people found out like The Crow,
it surged in video sales. Like, yeah, it definitely did better on video because of that, for sure.
And they actually delayed the video release, like here, rather than the UK, just because of all of that. Anyway, the budget was $10 million and it grossed over $14 million. Yeah,
that's pretty good.
I mean, especially for, you know, action movie like that. I mean, $4 million. Roger Ebert.
I was about to ask. Let me take a guess. I imagine Ebert hated this.
But what do you think his rating was?
I want to say he gave it. I'm just gonna take a guess.
There's 4 stars.
I've not looked this up. I promise, to be honest. Okay. I'm gonna guess he gave it 1.5 stars.
You're correct, sir.
I know Roger Ebert pretty well. Yeah.
He says, I quote, Martial arts movies generally make their money back and then some, perhaps because their fans are connoisseurs who evaluate the fight scenes and don't mind that the dialogue is brainless. Truly inspired action scenes do, of course, have a special energy of their own. Rapid Fire is not truly any of other kind of inspired.
That's a little mean, but yeah.
Would you agree or disagree?
I like the movie a great deal. I think it's a fun, like, meat and potatoes action film. If I was going to rate it on my own scale, which is a 5-star scale, okay, I would give it 3.5.
You would give it 3.5.
But a lot of that is based around the charisma and how much I like Brandon Lee as a performer.
Okay.
So I mean, like, if you put Van Damme in this film or Chuck Norris, it easily becomes like a 2-star movie.
The tomatometer or whatever, from Rotten Tomatoes. Yeah. Critics gave it 37%.
Understandable.
What do you think the audience gave it?
I'm going to guess 60.
55, so you're close.
Close?
Yeah. So not a critic's favorite. Audiences liked it a little bit more. Yeah, I think I'd rate it, you know. What did you say?
It's 3.5, yeah.
3.5, really?
Yeah. I like it, though. I mean, I'll say I'm a fan.
I will say I was very surprised how much I liked it, and I think it's mostly because of how what a fun movie it is, what a fun sort of ride movie it is to try to keep up, even though that it does have its own, like, little problems and stuff. Yeah. And, I mean, I might rate it 3 stars, but
that's cool. Yeah. Well, that tells me we should definitely watch some more action movies at some point. We'll go to action movies again at some point.
Yeah, I just have to watch them late at night after my kids are asleep.
You family man, you.
I know. I mean, you know, you can't show that.
You can't have your kids seeing, like, kung fu kicks to the head. And yeah.
This movie has nudity and violence and, you know, it's rated R for a reason, my friend.
Yeah, it is. And this was Ryan's father, you know, warning corner of the episode.
They're impressionable young children, okay? let's move on to The Crow. We've already talked a lot of trivia about it, but the director, Alice Parias, originally wanted the film to be black and white, but the studio would not let him, but shot it in a very monochromatic color theme.
Yeah, yeah. He definitely kind of got his way, even though it's still a color film. It's definitely stark. It's got really deep blacks, and there's not a lot of tone in between. You know, so it almost is like a black and white, like, expressionistic film.
Yeah, please watch it on a very well tuned, like, monitor, because you'll the shadows. Oh my gosh! Yeah.
And it's a pretty film. If you can get a good copy of it, and I have a nicely calibrated TV. It's a nice looking film.
Yeah, there's a lot of shadow depth in this movie,
yeah,
for sure. So yeah, you don't want to push it and clip the blacks there. Iggy Pop was producer's first choice for Fun Boy, but unable to commit due to his recording schedule.
Yeah. He later was in the sequel, which of course did not star Brandon Lee, and was not really related to the first film that much at all. The original character in the comic book was based on Iggy Pop.
Okay.
Where that came from. Like, if you look at the artwork for the comic, right, that character looks like Iggy, basically. Oh,
that's weird.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because the guy, like, he never wears, like, a shirt. He's always just got, like,
yeah,
kind of clown pants on, basically. Yeah. Like, yeah, the striped pants. Like I don't know. It's like you go to the rock star punk store, and it's, yeah, like, oh, here's your outfit. Okay, yeah, here's my pants. James O'Barr stated on the Crow DVD that when he met the movie's executives, they originally wanted to make this a musical starring Michael Jackson.
Yeah, which you can imagine that. And just to clarify for those of you who don't know, James O'Barr is the creator of The Crow.
Michael Jackson. He immediately laughed uncontrollably, thinking it was a joke. But they were quite serious. It was only until Brandon Lee and Alex Pirias came on board that the movie took a more serious role. Yeah, I don't think that he had Michael Jackson envisioned. Yeah.
Speaking of James O'Barr, the creator, did you know James O'Barr's in the film?
No.
He's in it for a brief moment. When the pawn shop blows up, when Eric Draven blows up Jojo Polito's pawn shop,
uh-huh,
you see looters grabbing stuff from the pawn shop and running off.
Uh-huh.
There's a guy who grabs a television, and the camera lingers on it for a second, and that is the creator of The Crow, James O'Barr. Yeah.
Wow, that's awesome. I have to go back and look at that scene. I will say this. I mean, this is how stupid the sort of the studio executives at Paramount are. Sorry, guys, but you, yep, are. Yep. If you think that this would be a good movie for Michael Jackson in a musical.
Yeah, that's just mind-boggling to, yeah, me.
So after Brandon Lee's death, I mean, this is probably something that a lot of people know or may not know what goes on, like, after films, but Paramount basically, like, dropped the film. After he died, they were like, no, we're not going to put it out.
Yeah.
You can do whatever you want to with it, but we're not going to put it out. So you got to pay us back. If somebody wants to, you know, if somebody wants to release it, they're going to have to pay us back, basically, for what we invested in it. So so Paramount dropped it. They said, no, we're going to continue. Miramax picked it up, and then they made all the money, which we'll get to the money aspect in a little bit later.
Yeah,
but I just thought I would throw that out there, yeah, as another, you know, mark against the Paramount executives.
Yeah, they had no idea what they were doing at that time period.
At least with this movie. I don't know all the decisions that they've made, but I'm just saying. According to John Polito, Brandon Lee cut himself when he broke the glass in Gideon's shop. So speaking of that scene, the glass was breakaway glass, and it's very rare to get anyone for anyone to get cut by it. How do you say his last name? Polito. Am I saying Polito?
I'm not sure how you pronounce it, to be
Polito
honest.
Polito said that he told Lee that he feared Lee would die in an on-set accident like Vic Morrow did during the filming of Twilight Zone, the movie. Oh, which, I mean, we talked about it when we did, you know, Into the Night, and, you know, it's one of those very sort of weird freak movie accidents, yeah, that happens.
Yeah, there's been whole books written about the Crow set and how it may have been cursed, so to speak. But the fact of the matter was, they probably shouldn't have a great safety person there on, right, set, and a lot of things probably could have been avoided. So it's just really unfortunate.
Well, it was filmed in Wilmington, North Carolina, which, you know, you don't really have, like, your top-notch, you know, yeah, Hollywood and prop guys there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're not talking about the mecca of, of studio production. A lot of people that worked on it were used to working on, like, TV sets and commercials and stuff. You know what I mean? So, anyway, let's move on. Even though the movie based on the comic is called The Crow, none of the birds used in the film were actually crows.
Yes.
All of them, in fact, are ravens, which are much larger than crows and have a much longer, impressive beak. Yeah. And I think at one point, doesn't he say, like, I rapped, or like when he enters,
yeah,
the,
he
when
closed,
he enters
he closed
the pawn
the raven,
shop.
Yeah.
He quotes the raven. Yeah. I rapped upon,
yeah, you know, your door. Did you hear me rapping? Yeah.
Okay, the soundtrack.
Well, actually, before we get into that, I've got some trivia I want to share. Some more obscure trivia, because honestly, right. I'm a big fan of this film. So I know a lot of things that not everyone knows. Alex Proyas was not the first choice for the director on this film. This film was almost directed by the great Italian spaghetti western horror director, Dario Argento. He almost did it. The film fans will know that name. But for laymen who don't maybe don't follow movies as closely, another director who almost made the film was Evil Dead's Sam Raimi. Yeah, he almost made the film. He came really close to being the guy who got the green light. Basically, Proyas got it because James O'Barr really liked Frank Proyas's work. He said it looked like his artwork.
Wow.
And Brandon Lee, it wasn't always just Michael Jackson they wanted to be the Crow. They actually had a lot of different guys that were almost the Crow.
Johnny Depp was one of the guys
that they kind of thrown around. The guy who came the closest to getting it besides Brandon Lee was, oddly enough, someone we've talked about on the show before, Christian Slater. Can you imagine the Crow with Christian Slater doing his Jack Nicholson voice?
God. Yeah. Jack Nicholson, who did play the Joker in Batman.
Yeah.
You know.
But isn't that kind of a, imagine the alternate world where Sam Raimi directed a Crow movie starring Christian Slater. What that would have been like. And there's one other piece of trivia that I think is really neat that I just learned today.
You know, it's kind of how things happen. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. When they had to make the movie work, when they had to film those scenes to kind of patch it over, they had a stuntman, you know, act as Brandon Lee. That stuntman went on to be a stuntman on The Matrix. His name is Chad Stahelski. When he was on the Matrix, he was a stunt double for Keanu Reeves. He became good friends with Keanu Reeves, and later on, he became the director of a very popular film series called John Wick. So yeah, Brandon.
Which John Wick is also a very sort of like vengeful, you know, sort of death, like
almost a vengeful spirit in a way.
Yeah.
So yeah, the Brandon Lee stunt double in The Crow is the guy who directed the John Wick trilogy. Isn't that neat? Yeah.
All right.
Anyway, the soundtrack.
You're blowing my mind here.
The soundtrack, yeah.
All right.
Best soundtrack of the 90s, in my opinion.
Well, a lot of people would agree with you.
Really good.
I mean, and I will say this. Look, a lot of these artists sign up to do this before they knew about Brandon Lee's death. At least The Cure did. I don't know about all the rest of them, but I know that, like, Stone Temple Pilots is in the movie. So you can't like be in the movie and just like sign up at the last minute or something like that, okay? Yeah. But The Cure, Stone Temple Pilots, Nine Inch Nails, Rage Against the Machine, The Violent Femmes, Rollins Band, Helmet, Pantera, My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult, and The Jesus and Mary Chain.
That is a murderer's row of badass alternative rock of the 90s.
Yes.
Like all those bands are still good if you go back and listen to them. Those bands
are still touring.
Yeah. All those bands have aged incredibly well. Some of them are still relevant today. I mean, and a lot of the songs they did on that were originals for the film.
Right.
But they're not anywhere else. You can't go buy the Nine Inch Nails record and get, you know, Dead Souls or, you know.
The Cure actually didn't even play that song like live, even hardly.
Yeah,
you know?
they never played. They never played that song. And like most of the songs, you cannot get anywhere else but that soundtrack. And those songs are killer.
The only sort of exception was I think Big Empty by Stone Temple.
Yeah, Big Empty was one of the few that you could get on a studio record. But that song was huge. That became a hit not because of Stone Temple Pilots, because of The Crow, because they put that song in the trailers and commercials for The Crow, and it was on TV all the time.
Yes.
That song became synonymous with The Crow, that kind of twangy, that kind of sad twangy guitar riff, you know?
Right. I mean, that really super launched their career.
It did.
They only really had like one sort of hit before then, but it was almost like a the I am smelling like a rose and the body gave me because I'm dead and bloated.
Which is a great, then, which I like that song.
Which is a great song, but it they almost became like this one hit wonder if it wasn't for like the Crow the like, picking them up
being on the soundtrack. Yeah. And like Nine Inch Nails was still a really new band when that song when that soundtrack came out. You know, the really only bands that were really a super established were like the Rollins Band and the Cure and
I mean, some of these bands, you know, you would have had to stay up really late at night on a Saturday night to midnight to watch 120 minutes on MTV
with Matt Pinfield,
and you would know with Matt Pinfield. And you would know who the Jesus and Mary Chain is, or you would know who the Nine Inch Nails are, or you would know who My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult is.
Yeah, My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult are actually in the film. They're actually the band playing in the club before one of the big action sequences near the end.
Right.
And, yeah, the soundtrack is so good.
So good.
I wish I could, you know, mail a copy to everyone who listens to this, because you should have the soundtrack in your life. It should be on your Spotify. It should be in your iPod. Everyone needs the soundtrack.
Well, the soundtrack in 1994, to go back to our facts, spent 1 week at the number one album on Billboard's Top 200 in 1994. Only 38 film soundtracks have ever made it to Billboard's Top 200 number one list.
Yeah. And that's pretty rare. Yeah.
Right. I mean, some of them will show up like on the list somewhere. You know, they'll debut at like 148 or something like that. But to be the number one record for that week, the number one album
overall
for that week, that means all categories, not just the top, you know, rock or the top soundtracks.
Yeah,
I mean, we're talking about every single genre. Yeah. You sold more than anybody else.
Yeah, I had this album on cassette. It was the first time I ever heard Helmet. First time I'd ever heard the Rollins Band. And, you know, it's the first time I heard a lot of these bands who later went on to be very important to me.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just as important, as influential as the movie is, the soundtrack is almost equal to it in relevance and importance as a cultural milestone.
Right. I will say one of the first soundtracks to ever make it to number one on the top 200, Purple Rain.
Another group we're gonna do Prince at some point. We're gonna watch that in one of his other terrible movies. I'm gonna insist on it.
All right. I mean, but just to give you an example, of some of the other movies, like
how big it would have to be.
But some of the other things that made it up there were like the, you know, Beverly Hills Cop.
Beverly Hills Cop. It's interesting you mentioned that
Harold
one.
Faltermeyer. Which I wrote an article about, which you can read all about on video-culture.com. But also, what was one of the other movies that I saw? I can't remember. Like the Miami Vice soundtrack. Yeah, I mean, even though that's not a movie, that's still considered a soundtrack.
Yeah, but think about how big those soundtracks were in their time period. That's how big the Crow soundtrack was. Again, it goes back to every girl I knew was obsessed with the Crow.
Right.
Every kid I knew had the Crow soundtrack.
Yeah, I mean,
you know?
Yeah, and they dressed like Eric Draven at Halloween. Yeah.
For years afterwards.
Yes. And people still do.
Yeah.
They still go to conventions dressed like Eric Draven.
Because it's such a cool, iconic look.
Yes. The T-Bird's car is a 1973 Ford Thunderbird. And I'll mention that because, you know, I know car
people.
And
it's a cool car.
It is a very cool car. The film opened at number one in the United States in 1,573 theaters with 11 million, averaging about close to $7,500 per theater. The film ultimately grossed just over $50 million.
Which at the time was a lot of money.
So it's a $23 million budget and then grossed $50
million. Yeah.
I mean, it doubled what they put in.
Yeah, there's a reason there's a bunch of sequels and a TV show.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, to go back to the tragedy of Brandon Lee, he had signed on to do a sequel and a third one. And they had to change the whole idea once he passed away.
Right.
And he, like I said, the whole landscape of this would have been very different if he had lived.
Well, and I think it's one of those movies, like I said, that we know works. But it's like where Brandon Lee died, and it's also kind of about, you know, death and love and life and how it all sort of like works. And I mean, and to have like, you know, where he's, he's righting a wrong. He's like bettering the city. He's like, you know, kind of this vigilante, you know, sort of justice kind of thing.
Kind of an avenging angel. Yeah,
exactly. Okay, it didn't get nominated for any sort of like
no major awards for
major
sure.
Major awards. Won some MTV. Got nominated for some MTV Movie Awards. For Best Actor, for you know, for Brandon Lee. Yeah,
it's a very MTV type movie.
Yeah,
know?
And Best Movie of the Year. But they didn't win. But it did win for Best Song for Stone Temple Pilots for Big Empty.
Yeah, I can't imagine what MTV thought was the better movie that year than that, because to me, The Crow is like the perfect MTV movie.
I will have to look that up.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on.
But
the Roger Ebert gave it 3.5 stars,
which is basically almost perfect on his 4-star scale. Because you know, again, his scale is 4 stars. My personal one is 5, but his is 4. So 3.5, that's huge praise.
Yeah, especially for, you know, this really type of movie.
Yeah.
It's not something that he would really say, you know, yeah, wow. I mean, I still can't believe that it's not, you know, even to him, not a 4-star movie and only like 3.5. So I didn't read this time. I didn't have time to like read through his whole like synopsis, but I think that he just thought some of the characters were really sort of, you know, sort of outlandish and just silly.
Are, for
yeah,
sure.
Right. But he will say this is one of the, I did take this quote from it, from his review. The Crow, with his fast pace and its countless camera setups, evokes comics much more than the movie. Oh no, much more than the more good-looking but leisurely Batman movies.
That's
it also
true.
Reflects a bleak modern sensibility with little room for the comic villains in Batman. Now, the Batman that he's talking about
is a Batman 89 or Batman Returns.
Yeah, yeah. And really, to be quite honest, those movies were like the biggest, most successful comic book movies up till that time period. You know, and so it was like those were sort of setting the example, or yeah, like sort of like the milestone
it
that
was
everybody
kind of the only thing you had to compare it to. Yeah,
right. Yeah. Because you kind of had like, you know, some of the Supermans before that, yeah, and you had, you know, whatever. But, you know, he's comparing it to, you know, comparing it to that, which is to me, it's good. And to me, it's bad, because it's kind of like, you know, this is a new thing. You know, you almost can't compare it to those, because this is something completely different.
Well, I think when you're writing for the public, you have to try to draw parallels that they'll understand. I think that's where that comes from a little bit.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that makes sense. Rotten Tomatoes.
I'm going to guess. I have not looked because I find this fun to do. I'm going to guess 70% positive.
81.
Nice.
Yeah, by critics. And then the audience score, 90%.
I was going to say people love this movie.
Yeah. I mean that's pretty high up on the audience score to be in the 90s.
Yeah. This is a beloved film by
very
a lot
much
of people.
So.
By me especially. Like, again, I love this movie.
Right. I highly recommend it to anybody, and like I said, there's so many other movies I think that it sort of influences, and you can see that in the later movies, like you said, even for like a whole decade, you know, after it. So the movie that 1994.
I'm dying to know. Yeah,
Menace to Society.
Menace to Society is really good.
Okay,
it is a really good movie. All right. In all fairness, it's a good movie.
Right,
and it's good. I can't say it's better than The Crow, but that's apples and oranges.
Let's see who won for Best Actor. I mean, but you have to remember they gave away awards like Best Kiss and Best Villain and stuff like that.
It's kind
that,
of fun
right?
to be nostalgic and remember, for sure.
Yeah. I'm looking up the awards. Sorry. The other movies that were also nominated for Best Movie were The Fugitive, Jurassic Park, Philadelphia, and Schindler's List. Wait a second. I don't see.
Yeah. Man, that was a great year for the movies, and if those were the other nominees, yeah.
Wait a second. I don't see The Crow.
Are you sure you're not looking at the right year?
Would it have been 1995 then?
It would have been 95.
Yes, it was 95 because it was released in 94.
Okay.
So the movie that won in 95 was Pulp Fiction. So the other movies that it was up against were Forrest Gump, Interview with a Vampire, and Speed.
because I saw Speed a bunch too that year because that came out right after The Crow did. And
okay,
yeah, and I loved Bill and Ted, so I saw Speed a bunch.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, Pulp Fiction's really great. Yeah, I mean, those are definitely two like quintessential '90s movies.
Right.
You can't go wrong with any of those movies. We really just rambled off.
Best male performance. Okay, so now that I see the winner, I'm like, oh yeah, now I know why he won.
Oh yeah.
And you'll laugh too.
Okay.
Well, I'll just name all the nominees and I'll save the best for last.
Okay.
All right. So we already know Brandon Lee, Tom Hanks in Forrest Gump, Keanu Reeves in Speed, John Travolta in Pulp Fiction, and Brad Pitt in Interview with a Vampire.
He's
who won? Brad Pitt.
He's really pretty in that film, is all I can say. Yeah, I get why that would happen.
Right.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's
in retrospect, that's ridiculous.
Right.
But
but I mean, you have to be honest. I mean, it's not based upon like merit or
no,
you know,
not whatever. At all.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So I gotta say, so to kind of wrap up, we always talk about this. Would you keep both these? If you were renting these films from the video store, would you keep them an extra day and watch them again?
Yeah. I probably would keep them an extra day. I mean, to be quite honest, you know, Rapid Fire, I mean, it's such a fun movie. I mean, you can just like watch it like, oh, I want to watch the cool like action movie.
Yeah,
and, like,
it's super light. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel the same way. Like I said, I like Rapid Fire a lot. I love The Crow. The Crow is one of the building blocks of my movie fandom. I've got a poster from The Crow hanging in my living room, signed by a majority of the cast, which I'll take a photo of and post it on our Twitter.
Oh, please do.
And I've also got an original sketch from the creator of The Crow, so I'll post both these things on the Twitter when the show comes out.
Oh, from original sketch.
Yeah, I met James O'Barr.
Wow.
Came to Nashville once.
Okay.
And I got a drawing of The Crow done by him for me. Like it wasn't already made. I actually got him to draw one for me.
Wow.
It actually says on there, to Matthew. It's one of my prized possessions. If my house ever catches on fire, that's what I'm grabbing when I run out of the house. So I'll take photos of both those and show them off on Twitter. But I say that not to brag, but just to illustrate how much I love this movie.
Yeah.
It really is part of my movie-loving DNA.
Right. And like I said, you can watch it. If you haven't seen it, highly recommend you stop what you're doing. And the next movie you watch on Netflix, because I think it really transcends like time, and I mean, even in today, even everything that you've seen in the past, if you've never seen it, it's still going to be new to you.
Yeah.
And it's still a fantastic movie. You can watch it on Netflix, or like me, I mean, I picked it up on Laserdisc for like $2.
Yeah, you'll have to take photos of it. Anything you have on Laserdisc, we got to start showing off on the Twitter as these episodes come out.
Right.
I think that's super fast. It's fascinating to me. So if anything, I want to see it.
Yeah. I mean, it is cool. Like, I mean, we talked about it on that episode. But yeah, like this big 12-inch, you know, thing. Like an album
cover, yeah.
Yeah. But they're different than album cover. They're kind of glossy because they're done like really expensive.
Yeah.
Like album covers could never do that because there was never enough money for that kind of thing. But
yeah,
it's super cool. I mean, it's very accessible. I mean, you can find it almost any format, you know.
So you mentioned that you recommend that people watch this on Netflix. Do you have any other recommendations to go along with these films? Anything stylistically or you think would work well with it, or do you just want to share?
I was trying to think about that, and I mean, we've talked about other movies that it sort of influenced, but one of the movies I thought about when I was watching these movies, especially just watching like The Crow, was the movie Boondock Saints, which, you know, this is a very sort of like high body count movie, but it's also one of these movies that it's like violence with a vigilante sort of like, there's not as much like fighting or street fighting or whatever, but sort of like this vigilante justice, where these two Irish, you know, young guys, you know, go after like these kind of gangsters, and it's a very fun film to watch.
And I guarantee you, the guy who made that film was a fan of The Crow, for sure.
Yeah.
And my recommendation, I mentioned this earlier, but like I said, Brandon Lee borrowed some of the fight sequences for Rapid Fire from Hong Kong movies, and one of them is a movie that Criterion just put out on Blu-ray. It stars the immortal Jackie Chan, called Police Story. It's a simple, like, cops and robbers, you know, action film where Jackie plays a policeman, obviously. and some of the action sequences in Rapid Fire were directly lifted from this film. Police Story is one of the all-time great action films, and it just came out on home video. I highly recommend people track it down. It is so worth watching.
All right, sounds good. Well, two you know, great movies. Another movie that, you know, I'd never seen that I'm gonna have to, you know,
I will
put it on my list to like watch.
I will lend you my copy. Jackie Chan films are, especially from like the early 80s, are super fun.
Right.
But I just want to say, you know, I miss Brandon Lee, and I'm glad we got to do this one, because I'm a huge fan, and to this day I think about what he could have been if things had gone differently.
Yeah, there's a lot of movies I sort of think about. You know, we talked about the movies would have been different if somebody else was in The Crow, yeah. But I think about what movies would have been different had he been in them, yeah, like, instead. Like, what if he was in The Matrix? Yeah. What if he was in, you know, yeah, like, some movie that Will Smith was in?
Yeah, he could have been like in Enemy of the State, in those kinds of things. He would have eventually. The Crow may not have been a big hit. He would eventually have been a big movie star, though. Yeah. He would have hit at some point, and it's kind of, I get sometimes wistful thinking of what could have been.
Right.
But so I just want to say I'm so glad we did this. Thank you for taking a chance on my recommendation this week. This was my recommendation that we do these.
Yeah.
I really
you took my chance on, you know, going with FM.
And I loved FM, yeah. And it's fun. We can trade like that. And I'm glad you enjoyed these. I look forward to next week, or our next episode
in
2 weeks.
All right. Sounds good. Well, we'll see you guys in 2 weeks. Until then, take care.
I'm Matthew Estri.
I'm Ryan Acree.
Go watch some movies, guys.
One day we'll get that down.
Maybe.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, coming out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
Oh, goodness.